And Marlon said, "He's not lying." And I just wouldn't believe him. I really thought in the Gooden people that, you know, how can you lie in a deposition with all those people? And I remember going up there with all these government attorneys in the elevator and thinking, this is serious. He's not going to lie. But he did.
Corporate fraud works best in the shadows, behind corporate walls. How does the government bring these wrongdoers to justice? Whistleblowers. These are the stories of those who risk their careers to shine a light on allegations of fraud. Today on Fraud in America.
Hello, this is Jeb White, and welcome to Fraud in America. In this episode, we are heading down to Florida to spend time with whistleblower Ellen Kuntz and her attorney, Marlon Wilbanks. Ms. Kuntz brought a false claims act whistleblower case against her employer, Halifax Health, alleging that Halifax knowingly and intentionally submitted thousands of fraudulent claims to Medicare. In addition, Mrs. Kuntz alleged that Halifax paid kickbacks and illegal compensation to key referring physicians in order to generate patient referrals to the hospital. It was announced on March 3, 2014, that Halifax Health settled the Medicare illegal physician compensation allegations for $85 million. At the time, it was the largest Stark Law settlement in our nation's history. Well, today, we go beyond the numbers to learn the full story from whistleblower Ellen Kuntz and her attorney, Marlon Wilbanks.
Well, Ellen and Marlon, I want to thank you guys for joining us today on Fraud in America. When we thought about doing this, actually, we originally thought about doing this in 2008, as I went back and looked at my notes, but podcasts and things like that weren't really around then. It was going to be something much different. But as we thought about doing podcasts and a YouTube show, you guys were at top of the list, because I think in many ways, the relationship you guys had during the case and certainly after the case is something to be emulated and spotlighted for future whistleblowers. But the one thing that I always like to start off with when I talk to whistleblowers who've gone through the process is that moment where you made the decision to step forward as a whistleblower. Can you talk about the emotions and kind of the thought process at that moment when you decided, you know what, I'm going to step forward?
Wow. Well, yeah, for me, it was a long process in the sense that I had for a whole year looked at different ways that I could communicate what we were doing as fraud and how it could cost us a lot of money. I would continue to bring up issues that I was actually afraid I eventually would get fired because I kept, you know, being in their face with these issues. And I think the breaking point for me was that after I had brought up the issue with Stark, kind of had everyone agree with me that we were in violation. And then I thought that we were going to self-report, and I kind of moved on and thought, you know, it's being self-reported, everything is taken care of. And then 6 months later, I realized that we never self-reported. We paid the physician their incentive anyway. It just dawned on me that not only had we committed fraud, you know, I was afraid of it actually being criminal, that we were covering it up. And I thought I could be under the bus. And when I first called Marlon, I was hoping he could tell me, you can leave your job, you can move on, don't participate, just leave and I'll be fine. I did not want him to tell me I had to file this lawsuit, because working in compliance, you know what that entails. And I just wanted him to tell me, no, Ellen, it's going to be okay. You need to leave your job and move on. And obviously that didn't happen.
Right, right. So I really appreciate that that moment of decision. You know, there's so many people probably watching today and listening today who are probably in that position of saying, you know, do I go along to get along or do I try to move forward? So I appreciate you sharing that today. I want to go back a little bit, though. You have an amazing backstory that goes back to Norway, right? Can you talk a little bit about your childhood and why you decided to come to the United States?
Well, when you live in a small country with 4 million people at the time, everyone has to learn a language. So you can go to England and learn English, or you can go to Germany or France, or you can go to the U.S. And I came to the U.S. as an au pair right out of high school. Also decided to go and get my bachelor degree in the United States because the family needed a nanny to continue to stay there. So I signed up for accounting, and finance, which is what I wanted to do. But as an international student, everyone talked about the speech class and how hard that was when English is not your first language. So I actually changed my major to hospitality to not have to do a speech class. And the reason I bring that up is I do a lot of talks across the country to students and, you know, doctors and lawyers. And I'm standing in front of people talking about regulations, and it doesn't scare me because I'm so passionate about what I'm talking about and educating. But if you go back to when I was 21, and I didn't start college till I was 21 either, because in Norway we traveled for 2 years before we go back to school. So the fact that I'm actually spending my time talking to all these colleges when I would not even get up in front of people for a small speech class, I think is significant. You can absolutely change. So I kind of use that as, don't be afraid sort of thing. And I think my experience, I think a lot of people that get, a large reward, they just kind of go away. And I feel like if you do, there are so many whistleblowers who don't get a reward that I feel like we're the only voice to help them. That's why I continue to speak. And it's very, very important to me. So going back to Norway too, we grew up with something called the Jantelov, which kind of teaches us that we're nothing special. You shouldn't think you're better than anyone else. So when people at my hospital, 4,000 employees, respected administration, looked up to them, wouldn't question what they did, I would look back and think, just because they're in their high position doesn't mean that what they're doing is the right thing. You can't just blindly follow them. So I'm not saying I'm a rule breaker. I'm actually a rule follower, I think, but I didn't blindly just follow what I was told to do. So that, I think my background has a lot to do with that. And I also feel like in my little town where I grew up, everyone would have done what I did because it's the right thing to do. It's kind of like the sandbox. You know, you're supposed to stand up for other people that are hurt, and you do that no matter what. So that's the only thing where I can say from Norway kind of shaped my decision making. And what's interesting, when I called Marlon that first time, one of my questions was, because I'm a Norwegian citizen, does that mean I don't have to do anything? And again, you know, that didn't work either. I was looking for any way to not have to file this case because I didn't want to be that person. And I actually had a lot of anger when I realized I didn't have a choice. And that's why I call it a choiceless choice, because there was no choice to not do anything.
Thank you for that background. It really highlights so many things. A lot of people probably were in your shoes for sure, right? They recognized what was going on, but they decided to make a choice to do nothing. That's very, very interesting. So when you came over to the States, you settled in Florida and started at college, and then eventually went back and got your MBA. Is that right?
Yes. So I had actually worked at the hospital, I want to say maybe 3 years when I went back for my MBA, because I started in food nutrition in the side of the hospital, and I wanted to move into finance, not necessarily at the hospital, but I wanted to get my finance background. So I went back for my MBA. Once I had it, we had a hire freeze, and I went to talk to finance just before I put in my resignation, and they actually created a position for me in finance. And I worked there for 8 years before compliance contacted me about this new position, and I moved into compliance. And another thing that's interesting with my case is I was in compliance for 4 years, I think, before I was promoted to director of physician services. And I think the day before Halifax found out that I was the whistleblower, my former compliance officer, that was my boss, he was the compliance officer during the case, actually came to my office the night before. I knew they were going to have the meeting in Orlando and offered me a nice promotion and additional training to come back to compliance. And I remember telling Marlon, I said, they really don't know it's me. He just offered me this great promotion to go back. But as you know, the next day I was the official disgruntled employee from then on, because I worked from the time they found out that it was me who was the whistleblower, I was still there for over 4 years. And even 6 months after the case settled. So Marlon can tell you about that.
Why did you decide to go to compliance? What was it about compliance that piqued your interest?
It's interesting. So what piqued my interest in compliance was, when you work in finance in a hospital, there's two sides to finance. It's the general ledger side that works with accounting, that accounts for all the expenses. You do budget. We had a $500 million budget. I love doing the budget side. No one in finance likes what's called the charge description master. That's the price list. And it has about maybe 30,000 line items of prices. And at one point, they lost the person doing the charge master. And I kind of volunteered because no one wanted to do it. So I kind of wanted to learn it because, it, you know, can it be that bad? And once I went into the charge master side, and then from there moved to the patient accounting side, I realized that, wow, this was like a whole other part of finance I had never seen. But again, it was only about spreadsheets. But now I started having access to what happens on the patient side, completely different side of finance. The one side doesn't know what the other one does. And this is where I had started understanding that coding, medical coding and ICD-10 diagnosis is what drives all the revenues at the hospital. So when compliance contacted me, they wanted me to become a certified coder where I would learn that side. And no one in finance had any understanding for that other than that case mix index was a number to them. They didn't really understand the detail with the physician document. So it was an opportunity to learn a whole side of the finance at the hospital being in compliance. And my compliance officer that hired me used to work in finance and was in charge of the patient accounting. So he had seen my skills and offered me this job, wanted me to get certified. I got certified on the physician coding side and the hospital coding side, which was at the time very difficult because you typically only focus on the one. But because he was very demanding, I got to learn both. And it was before my depositions, when they flew attorneys down from DC to interview me for the case, they thought I was a great person at Halifax that had all this information. I remember they came from DC with large bags of heavy folders. They had every one of my emails printed out. And I remember them saying, you know, wow, you did a lot of stuff. And my response was, yes, I had a very demanding boss. So I saw the whole business.
Jim, I wanted to add about some color to what Ellen said about the choiceless choice. When we first started our dialogue, which went on for months, it was a very emotional time for her because Ellen is a very loyal person.
Yeah.
And she liked the people that she was working with, but knew that there was fraud going on, and she couldn't understand. Here I'm, you know, from Norway, these other otherwise stand-up people are aware of this, but because they're making money, these things are, you know, basically the compliance looked good on paper, but was a sham in reality, because in the unusual situation of Halifax, the compliance reported to finance. And largely because I think Ellen's case and some of the success we had, you started to see the paradigm shift where compliance was not reporting directly to finance. But Ellen, she really only had two questions. Was she right about the law? Was her training right that what she was seeing was fraud? And when the answer to that was yes, then her frustration began because she said, well, why aren't they changing? If I'm telling them this, they're not listening to me. And I said, Ellen, they're not listening to you and they're never going to listen to you because fraud is profitable. And that was hard for her to understand and to accept that it was just that was the way a lot of business is done. But the straw that broke the camel's back, to your question, Jeb, was when she started seeing some statistics such as one neurosurgeon was doing 222% of the spinal fusions compared to the other two neurosurgeons together. out of the same patient pool. And when patient safety began to, in her mind, become an issue, then it really, I guess, Ellen, that really is the choiceless choice. At that point, it's not just a matter of the taxpayers getting cheated. It's is there a human impact for the various things that she was seeing going on there at Halifax. So it was a very emotional arc that she had about getting somebody to reassure her that she's right, somebody to tell her, no, they're not going to change, and then her coming to the conclusion, I've got to do this.
And how long did that take, that process, that evolution?
Gosh, how long?
3 months, at least 3 months.
Wow.
3 months and more than 100 phone calls, put it like that.
Yeah, because after the 3 months, I questioned that even when we had filed, that maybe they would do something to where we could just kind of like stop the lawsuit and go away. And to show you, I mean, Marlon literally dragged me through this for 5 years. I owe him so much in having to put up with me for those 5 years, because I just thought that they would do the right thing. And to give you an example, my former boss, the compliance officer, who was my mentor, I adored him. It was time for his deposition. And I told Marlon, I said, he's going to tell the truth. Of all the people, he's going to tell the truth. And Marlon goes, it's $1 billion on the line. He's going to lie. And I just wouldn't believe him. And I remember sitting in that deposition, and when they asked him, if he thought the peer review was done on my behalf for my case, you know, he flat out lied and said, I initiated that. When in fact, the peer review should have happened 3 years before I even filed the case. I didn't even find out about it till much later. And the fact that he lied in front of all these people on video, I was just devastated. I remember driving home. I don't remember driving home. But I do remember getting home. Our bedroom at the time was upstairs. I couldn't make it up the stairs. My legs didn't work. I was emotionally devastated that he lied. And Marlon said, please don't lie. And I just wouldn't believe him. I really thought in the good in people that, you know, how can you lie in a deposition with all those people? And I remember going up there with all these government attorneys in the elevator and thinking, this is serious. He's not going to lie. But he did.
You know, that's a common story.
It's the other thing that was that I told her that was really hard on Ellen was that, look, they are going to do everything they can to discredit you, to blame you, and they're even going to go after those that are closest to you within the hospital. And she didn't really, you know, believe that, but that happened, of course, as well. She loved the institution. She'd been there forever. People that were her friends couldn't have lunch with her, couldn't speak to her. People would go down the hallway once they found out she was a whistleblower and make threatening statements to her. I couldn't understand why they left her there. I think it was a very bad defense move.
Yeah, I was going to ask you. Yeah.
But we loved it.
Right, because I'm sure. Absolutely.
She was a lightning rod. And you know, she got other people not there at the job site, but... Yeah. You know, after hours and other things, we started hearing other things that would buttress what we were saying. But they even moved her into a bad office from where she had been. And we got a lot of backdoor comments about really ugly things that they had said about attacking her, you know, that have parties or social things. And she would either not get invited or would be ostracized. I mean, they really emotionally tortured her. And of course, I'm loving it because while I'm trying to work with the government to get them very interested in the case. Yep. And they, of course, love Ellen. Everybody loves Ellen. They know she's telling the truth. And they see her being treated like this. And so that was something that I wanted to parlay into her benefit, that the suffering she's going through at work. And they just kept her there. It was crazy. I would have paid her. I wouldn't have retaliated, but I would have taken her out of that scenario. And I think they made a bad call.
This is for Ellen or Marlon. You know, it is something that, you know, I've seen over the last 20 years. It's the same story. It seems to play every single time. It's this betrayal of your coworkers turning their backs on you. And as much as we try to prepare people for that, it's hard to see it play out, right? And it seems to happen all the time. Ellen, what are for those people who are hearing this story and they're hearing about what you went through, and you came out on the other side and made an impact, not only at Halifax, but on the industry. Marlon talked about earlier about compliance, not reporting to finance at a lot of health systems now across the country. And a lot of people cite this case. But what do you say to those people who are listening to this right now and they're where you were in that period, that 3 month period, talking to Marlon?
Well, one thing is when you are starting a job and you see these things and you see a culture which is as wrong as ours was, don't stay 20 years like I do. At that point, you have eliminated your choices. And again, that's very hard when you have little kids and you can't just jump around or travel for work. I was in a position where I wasn't about to start over, maybe losing my house or anything like that. I've been a saver my whole life and I refused to give up. So I just went to work every day. But at the same time, when you're in a position like me, and when I worked in finance, everything is just a number in a spreadsheet. But when you move over to when you're looking at medical records, all of a sudden there's patients with names and you start thinking about your own parents. So at that point, you have to speak up. And when you look at what's going on with COVID too, you know, if there are fraud or something going in a hospital, I hope people would speak up. And that's why I continue to tell my story is when I'm in a hospital one day, I want people to speak up, do the right thing. Yes, it's not going to be easy on you. I mean, you have to be prepared for that, but it's the right thing to do. So it kind of cut for me. It came down to the fact that you put your kids to bed at night. Are you okay with your decisions? And I actually made my decision in a spreadsheet, the pros and the cons. And the one con that I couldn't get past is, you know, somebody can go to jail for this. And what if I'm thrown under the bus? So you speak up because it's the right thing to do. And that's what you teach your kids. Why wouldn't you do the same thing? And I continue to speak to students because these people that become CEOs one day that are driven by money, when they're students at the colleges, no one understands how anyone could treat me the way they did. But these are the same people that are going to sit in a conference room one day and tell you the lights are off when they're on. I remember sitting in a conference room when we went over the peer review and everyone looked at me and said, I'm the only one who has an issue with this. And I remember looking at the text in front of me and I'm like, are you kidding me? Are we not reading the same thing? Like, I was so sick, I had to throw up after reading that. And they're telling me, you're the only one who has a problem with this. So Just keep that in mind. You have to do the right thing.
One of the things that Ellen, that I did as an exercise with Ellen, and I'm sure she'll remember it, is there were so many different things that were wrong that, you know, to have a successful FCA case, you really have to focus on one or two things. You don't need 10 things that are wrong. You need one or two I use the word pegs that to hang your hat on, that you know there's fraud, you know it's lying, stealing, and cheating, and you know it involves government money. And she had all these different things, and we had to narrow it down. But what I did is drew out a tree, a decision tree, everything that they were doing that didn't make sense. And the one common denominator was it all was more reimbursement. It could be, common denominator, everything, all these different things, sometimes contradictory policies on inpatient admissions versus observation, on billing and coding, why certain doctors did this that were important and others weren't. And the one common denominator was it followed the money, the fraud follows the money. But as an aside to what Ellen was saying in your question to what she means now to the industry, after the case was over, I was asked to do a presentation. I was kind of routinely do presentations for the Healthcare Compliance Association. And of course, it was after Ellen's case, and she was a compliance person, obviously. And when I told her story and we talked about the case, I couldn't wait to call her till after they gave her a standing ovation. They all were moved. And these were people that were, you know, put in the vortex sometimes between finance and compliance and what their obligation and oath is versus doing the right thing. Ellen took that seriously, but that's how much she meant to them that somebody had stood up, you know, and had done the right thing. So that was moving for me. And I remember it was very moving for her because this is someone who had been ostracized for doing what she was supposed to do. But yet now she was being recognized for how there was a C-level change and gave confidence to other people to question within their institution, are we doing the right thing? So that you can't measure that with money, but that was very significant.
Yeah, I talked to the HCCA actually with your partner, Marlon, a few months ago and recently. And, you know, this question of, or this issue where a compliance officer is being made into a compliant officer, right? They're told, right, you just rubber stamp what we're doing here.
Right.
Really seems to get people's attention, especially, you know, people who go into compliance, and certainly Ellen is a great example, tend to have the highest level of ethics and integrity of the people that do it the right way. So I certainly appreciate that.
Can I add to that, Jeff?
Yeah, please.
So with my case, I think I may be one of the first whistleblowers that actually had the background in compliance. I had moved out of my compliance role, but I think it kind of opened up that door, because what we're told in compliance is if these things that I was seeing are happening, you should resign and move on. You should not blow the whistle. My problem was, at the time I'd been there 15, 16 years, you can't just move and not be involved. So, you know, do you want to then down the road pay your own attorney to defend yourself? I mean, that's what was part of my spreadsheet. And the other thing I want to say about Marlon and guiding this case is, there were so many things that was wrong at Halifax. I had this whole bucket of things, and I felt that I had to get this all off my chest. I had to tell everything. So when the government looked at this, they knew everything. And had I just done what a lot of people do, go to any attorney that's not a False Claims Act attorney, I'm not so sure it would have been as successful, because Marlon spent a great deal of time narrowing this down. And, you know, he would have to tell me that, yes, I know this is wrong, but we have to find somewhere to focus. We were giving them too much information. And I think when you do that much, it's hard to make it, like, it's hard for them to know where to focus. And I think Marlon being in that haystack and picking out, you know, if Stark's $1 billion in damages, you don't really need to look at all those other things. But for me, he had to constantly tell me, yes, I know they're wrong. But it's so much strategy behind this. And I think, you know, when you tell people you need an attorney to do this, you don't need an employment attorney, which is what a lot of people go to because they're retaliated against. For this to be successful, you have to have someone with the expertise of a False Claims Act attorney. And being in compliance, I found Marlon through the TAF website looking at his previous cases. And I think that is so important. You know, yes, you need to speak up, but you need to speak up to a False Claims attorney that has done this before, because it's very complicated.
You know, we talk about this being a public-private partnership between the relator, the whistleblower, and their counsel, and the government. But in many ways, the partnership between the lawyer, the QI-TAM lawyer, and the whistleblower, it's so important, right? I mean, you guys went up against a Goliath times with the government there, maybe reluctantly, it seems at times, and won. So can you talk about that relationship, Marlon, between the relator, the whistleblower, and their counsel, and why that relationship is so important?
Yeah, it's kind of like a marriage, really good marriage, nothing can be better. In a not so good marriage, you're at a depth of hell there, because the lawyer's kind of in the middle. The lawyer is, advocating for their client. They have to make sure the government understands the case in the most simple form possible, because they're not going to chase 8 different avenues. You have to really look for the low-hanging fruit. And it's very difficult sometimes with your client, because they may have more emotional collateral in something that's going on there that the government is doesn't want to get into, because maybe there's an agency issue and the CMS doesn't really mind that. Yes, that's illegal. Yes, it's wrong. But are they really going to invest any resources in that? And it's kind of like a referee. I mean, yes, client, you're right. They do believe you, but yet they're going to leave money on the table. That's a hard dialogue to have. But then from their standpoint, resource allocation, having to make decisions, it's tough, but it really is a partnership that works great, particularly if there's documents that are being shared between under a common interest agreement, where they can fill in a couple of pieces of the puzzle you don't have. When you're out there on the island, that sometimes relators like Ellen was for a while in certain parts of her case that was partially intervened in, partially not, it's a much difficult route. And that's why we were blessed in Ellen's case, because she literally was the ultimate insider. She knew that some of the things that she was saying, she actually had not just documents in her opinion, but she actually had studies that were done in within her department that showed the trends and showed the overbilling, the upcoding, the overutilization of inpatient admission. She actually had that. So when I have that, that really helps me with the government in the middle. That helps me. But you really do have to be part lawyer, part strategist, and sometimes referee, because you don't want your client to totally emotionally let go of the case when the government won't accept part of their case that they know is true. And you want to keep the government engaged in case they decline. And you, if you want them to come back in and intervene, you really have to do a good job of giving them the right information to pique their interest. So it's a very unusual scenario that our friends in the defense bar, they're really ask about that a lot. They don't really understand that those relationships that are going there. And I think you can't teach it. A lot of it's gut feeling. A lot of it is just innate ability to kind of navigate and skate on that thin ice. But it's very important to keep both the government and your client as engaged as is possible in the circumstance.
Marlon and Ellen are putting on a masterclass today. I'm so glad you guys are joining us to hear this. This is really enlightening on so many levels. Ellen, at some point, so this case was filed in 2009. The government intervened in some things in 2011, but they didn't intervene in some of the claims. The decision to move forward without the government on some of those claims. Can you talk about that?
Well, Marlon can probably talk more about that, but the thing that was surprising to me is the case was filed in June of 2009. And then in June the next year, in June of 2010, the seal was lifted, which was very surprising to me because all the cases I had read about in compliance, you didn't find out about them until they were unsealed, maybe 5 years later, and there is a settlement. So I didn't think that after 1 year, my name would become public and it's unsealed. It never occurred to me. I'm not so sure I would have been able to file this case and agree to do it had I known that I had 1 year and then for the next 4.5, my name's going to be out there in retaliation. So I'm glad I didn't know that in advance. And what was even worse in all of that, then in June when it's unsealed, because they needed more, the government needed more time, Halifax didn't find out. And I kept being called in for interviews and all this stuff. It wasn't until October, I think it was October 20th of 2010, that Halifax found out. And they found out because the DOJ called them to a meeting in Orlando to tell them. And that, so the next day is when my retaliation started. But then when my depositions happened, well, first of all, the government didn't intervene. So here we are. And their defense was that, you know, if the government thought it was a good case, they would intervene. And they didn't at the time. And then at my deposition, before the government intervened, they were trying to make me get in trouble to say that I should have told them it was me. Like, why did I keep it a secret? And, you know, my only defense to that was your legal fees were $40 million. I thought for sure you would have watched the docket for those 3 months and see who it was, but they didn't. So, but Marlon can talk more about, you know, the intervention or the time. But for me, that was incredibly frustrating.
Yeah, but Marlon, this is a great question for you. So it was filed in 2009. They intervened in 2011. In our world, that's pretty quick. What is that? What happened in that period that things didn't move pretty quickly?
Yeah, I think that we developed some good evidence.
Yeah.
During that period of time, and you know, particularly as to some of the physician compensation arrangements that were there, they were much more interested in that than there were than the medical necessity issues that were very disconcerting to Ellen and myself. And it was really difficult for her when they didn't intervene, because at that point in time, Jeb, I know you remember, we and our bar fought for the intervention. It was intervention or go home.
Absolutely. You
know? That's changed a little bit since then, because some of us have had great success when there wasn't an intervention, and you know, recovered hundreds of millions, billions of dollars when the government said it's not even good enough to intervene in. But at that time, it was a big deal. And it also provided fuel for Halifax when Ellen's there and they're having a We Won party at the hospital. It's not even good enough. And the newspapers say, you know, and I'm trying to work the publicity too, because not only was Ellen a little naive, I was a little naive in that I thought, well, this is really bad. I mean, they've got executives that are dancing around with dollar bills all over them, calling the money man who's doing a skit for the employees, trying to drive revenue. And I'm seeing a lot of bad stuff that I know a jury would just eat with a spoon. Right. But I thought, well, if we can get to the board, to the big board at Halifax through publicity and let them know, because I knew their counsel would be telling them, their people, this is not right. This is a disgruntled employee. She's part of the problem. But so I often try to use, to get the real story out, you know, you try to use good media in an appropriate fashion. But even the media there were such powerhouses in that area. They're the dominant provider. I mean, they're right there by where they raced the Daytona 500, and they're affiliated with that race. And so much so initially that Ellen was horrified about them being able to, about her own attorney, if they were a Florida attorney, double-crossing her. That's one of the reasons she went across the line to me in Georgia. So they were a real powerhouse. And at that time as well, not only was it a bad signal to us they didn't intervene, but I think judges at that time weren't as acclimated to long periods of time before the DOJ does anything. You really have a presumption against you at that point. So we developed some great evidence. I had excellent co-counsel in that time, Scott Withrow, who works with me in a lot of my cases, and he just did a tremendous job of understanding and dissecting the contractual relationships and how they were overcompensating the top referring doctors, which is almost expected in this type of toxic environment. So he was very helpful in getting the government to see, you guys need to get here. This is easy. This is a layup. You need to come in here and join us, at least as to part of the case. We'll stay and work with you on the part you don't like, and we're not going to bog you down with that, but we'll support you if you'll come in. So at that time, they came in, and Adam Schwartz from DOJ primarily led the charge and did a really good job. And I think it was the kind of case the government likes, because they're not scattered all over the place. He was looking right down the physician relationships. We had the documents. Scott was an expert, and Ellen was tremendous with her recall. So this is one of the good situations where there really is that partnership that develops.
This is a great example of why it's so important for cases to go forward with or without the government. You know, we talked about in previous episodes, the evolution of this bar, the professionalism on the relators bar, and the case law, the good case law that's been made by relators going forward without the government. You know, but for these decline cases, we wouldn't have off-label marketing cases that return billions. We wouldn't have a lot of the kickback cases that return billions. It's great relators counsel and their clients moving these cases forward. And sometimes the government re-intervenes later in the day and calls them intervened cases, and it drives down the numbers of so-called decline cases. But these are all cases that have moved the case law in a beautiful direction. that have opened up the doors for future relators and government cases and have encouraged relators to step forward. So this is a great example of even when the government intervened in part of the case, the relators have the ability to go forward and move forward on meritorious parts of the case. Ellen, at some point on the 11th hour at the proverbial courthouse steps, they decided to settle. The defendants decided that they didn't want any more, right? Can you talk about that settlement, what your reactions were at the time, and do you have any ill feelings towards your former lawyers?
Well, the settlement, I believe, Marlon, happened on a Sunday night. And actually, the court, meaning the lawsuit, was supposed to start Monday morning. The jury was actually in the seats before it settled. I think Adam Schwartz with the DOJ was one of the last ones to find out because he was preparing for trial. So I was ready to go to trial that morning. I was probably on the phone with Marlon that Sunday. It seemed like every minute. And I think Halifax had actually flown their executives to D.C., where they were pleading the ability to pay. So there was a lot of things going on that weekend. And I didn't go to work on Monday, obviously, because I was supposed to be at the trial. And I had to use my vacation time for my three depositions and to go to trial. I had that from the Halifax attorney told me in writing that I had to use vacation time. Only employee that had to do that even when they deposed me. So I actually, when the case settled on Monday, I went to work on Tuesday, and they were shocked to see that I came to work. This was March, maybe 3rd or 4th, and I actually continued to work till the end of July.
Wow, I didn't know that.
But Marlon knew the ability to pay issue, that's what happened in the last hour, which was a big deal.
Yeah, it was a legal Hail Mary. Yeah. They were very politically affluent, and they wanted to go and kind of plead their case unilaterally. And they had could only pay a percentage of the 86 million or whatever. They could just pay a little bit, needed to pay it over time. But we had some information that was very important, and it dealt with, okay, if you can't pay it, what about your holding company that really is the 800-pound financial gorilla, and maybe we need to do some discovery there, and maybe we really need to dig in and see how many nickels are in your piggy bank. And suddenly, they found the wherewithal to write the full check immediately. But had we not have understood what was going on and just based the ability to pay on the documents that they picked out, we might have ran into that. But it literally settled on the courthouse steps. And it was a very fiercely and intensely battled with defense counsel, like Ellen mentioned. I don't know the exact amount, but I'm sure it was somewhere between $30 and $40 million that they spent while we were paid nothing. But it's always interesting then when you get ready to talk attorney's fees, they don't want to they spent that much money. They don't want to, you know, we've worked for nothing all those years and all that angst comes out. But the end of that little story is it turned out fine too, because we said we didn't get to go to trial, but we get to tell the whole truth to the whole world in justifying our attorney's fees. You're not out of the public spotlight. And I know what you did, and I know how you did it, and I'm going to tell that story. And suddenly there was another reconsideration.
Imagine that. Yeah. This is a point we always like to stress on the show. You know, and Ellen and Marlon is a good example. You know, Marlon and his the law firms that represented Ellen were paid their fees by the defendants. Ellen wasn't writing a big check to sign Marlon on the front end, spending hundreds of thousands of dollars of attorney's fees. And if you're finding that to be the demand from your attorney, you probably have the wrong attorney. No, you do have the wrong attorney.
So also, Jeb, to add to that is because I stayed at work, I went to work Tuesday when I was in our manager meeting where the CEO and the CFO had standing applause because it was only an $85 million settlement. You know, originally we were on the line for $1 billion. So they were the heroes in all of this, didn't lose their jobs, got all kinds of rewards in the community. So that was difficult for me. And their legal fees, in addition to the $86 million, was actually $40 million, which is a lot of money. Yeah. And when the relator share was 24.5%, and I don't think that was a lot of negotiation either. So that made me feel like getting such a high relator share that they valued the work that we did. So that was important to me. But I was also in the manager meeting where Halifax, in front of all the other employees, talked about the settlement and did a PowerPoint on how that money doesn't go back to the Medicare Trust Fund.
Wow.
So
Ellen, you know, a lot of people, after the case is over, we don't hear from them, but you have stepped up and encouraged other people who were in your shoes. You work with us at Taxpayers Against Fraud. You help advise us on our whistleblower initiatives. You travel the world even talking about your story. Well, why do you do that? Why is that so important to you?
Because only 20% of whistleblowers in the US get anything at all. And my hope is that whistleblowing shouldn't be this thing where you're a hero. It should be more, in my opinion, normalized, where it's the right thing to do. And I hope by continuing to speak that maybe organizations one day will hire a whistleblower. Because if you know that you can get a job after you blow the whistle, maybe you would speak up when something is wrong. And then, you know, hospitals would be safer for all of us if that would take place. And that's why I'm so passionate about that. It doesn't matter how much money you have. If you can't feel safe being in a hospital or, you know, whatever situation because people won't speak up because they lose their career, I think that's dangerous.
Amen. Marlon, for you, what is the lasting impact of this case?
You know, I think that it, you know, totally empowers compliance people when they have stayed in their runway and tried to make changes internally, which is important for all your viewers. You know, it's not a gotcha situation. You really need to try as best you can to address it internally, which Ellen did. But I think it's empowered. I think it's empowered compliance individuals. I think another slightly more nuanced impact, but still very important, is we had some incredibly important legal battles during her case, like dealing with the attorney-client privilege and dealing with crime fraud. And like in the old days, 2009, defendants and hospitals would protect their documents, just stamp everything confidential, never mind if it's privileged or not, confidential. And that you don't have to give it over. We had battles over the privilege law as far as in Florida, what you have to do is very important. But the crime fraud fight is very meaningful. And her case is cited every day somewhere about that. Because what, you know, we said is, you know, when the attorney is involved, and she had some information at that, that one of the Halifax in-house attorneys had even acknowledged and knew that there were some illegal physician relationships and there were some things that had gone wrong, but yet there was still a decision to pay. That was uncharted water, and it's water that the DOJ is not comfortable with. Routinely, they don't like to do anything that could potentially invade the attorney-client privilege, and we got good decisions there because we had good facts. And so the impact of the case is, from a legal standpoint and for the members of our bar, it's very important. Also with regard to things like fair market value, if they want to use Halifax and they said, well, we got legal advice or we got fair market value advice, how can you say we intentionally did anything wrong? You know? Well, that case stood for the proposition. Well, okay, if you're going to stand on that and say that you're reasonable, we're entitled to find out what other legal advice did you get that was contrary, right? Or what are same in the fair market value realm. They can't just pick and choose and prostitute themselves out to the person that'll give them the number that they want to. So some of these things seem fairly basic now in 2021. They weren't that basic in 2009. We fought those battles. And so I think Ellen stepping forward had the ripple effect of kind of changing to level the playing field that we have to play on in this area of the law.
Absolutely. Well, Ellen, Marlon, I am proud to call you both my friend. I really appreciate the time you spent with us today. I acknowledge you both for your courage, your tenacity, your willingness to step forward, and also to pay it forward for future whistleblowers and establishing not only good case law, but the example for others to follow. So thank you so much for joining us.
What a remarkable story. The whistleblower story of Alan Kuntz shows that when an employee feels like their concerns are not being heard, there is help outside of the corporate walls. Because of Mrs. Kuntz's courage, she brought the allegations to the attention of the government by filing a False Claims Act whistleblower case. Today, she continues the fight by inspiring other should-be whistleblowers to stand up. Well, that story is also true for next week's episode, when we head down to Puerto Rico to spend time with whistleblower Cheryl Eckard Meads and her attorney, Leslie Skillen, as we go beyond the numbers in understanding her case against GlaxoSmithKline. That will happen here on the next episode of Fraud in America.
If you believe you've witnessed fraud against the government at your job or want to learn more about these important laws to combat fraud, visit fraudinamerica.com. On our website, you can find whistleblower lawyers, blogs from these expert attorneys, and more. You can also find a transcript of today's show, show notes, a way to contact our team, and a way to chip in to make sure we can keep bringing you the latest on fraud. This episode was edited and produced by Rachel Brooks, and our theme music is by Connor Chaos. A big thanks to our staff and researchers of Jeb White, James King, Emma Bass, Jackie DeMar, Kate Scanlon, Brian Markovitz, and Max Boltman. You can learn more about them at fraudinamerica.com/team. Fraud in America is a project of Taxpayers Against Fraud Education Fund.